My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Hello, everyone. This is Pin, and I'm a venture investor at Lightspeed Ventures Partner. Welcome to my show. This is a mini series that will explore the challenges and best practices of venture building in emerging markets through conversations with leading investors and founders across India, China, and Southeast Asia. Today, I'm really excited to have Jenny Lee, Managing Partner at GGV Capital, the fund behind multiple emerging market success stories such as Grab, New, Wish, Xiaomi, and so many more. Jenny launched GGV's first office in China and also heads up their Southeast Asia office today. Jenny, welcome to the show and thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Pin. Very happy to be here.
Awesome. I'll dive you right in. Jenny, so you've been in a front row seat of the rise of many household names, you know, across the world today because GGV actually invests across the globe. So tell us, what are the major differences between investing in emerging economies and more developed ones like the US and UK?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, we've been, you know, personally for myself and at GGV, we've been making investments in various markets for the last 20 years. US, China being our most mature market, and then more recently, our renewed focus in emerging economies in Southeast Asia, including India. So definitely the last 20 years, what we have seen that's, you know, if we play back the last 20 years, the key differences largely would be from a few areas. First areas definitely would be talent, right? So when we think about talent, 20 years ago, when we first went to China to make investments in China, the entrepreneurs, CEOs that we meet, first time. They're all first-time entrepreneurs, don't know how to read a term sheet, don't understand preferred share structures. Today, they are very mature, very sophisticated. I would say on par with the US in terms of the talent pool. And it's not just from their, you know, ability to work with venture capital, but also all the way we have seen that China has now, you know, emerged with a lot of, you know, unicorns, super unicorns, some of whom has surpassed even the US startups, right, in terms of the talent pool. And so what that does is that talent pool is a lot more mature. Now, if we look at, you know, again, if we take that playbook and we look at Southeast Asia and India, it's in a similar situation, right, where the talent that we are meeting, say, for example, in Indonesia, many of them are also first-time entrepreneurs. Many of them, you have to spend more time going through term sheets, trying to get them to understand what it means to have this first step, especially if we are seed or first-round institutional investor, to understand what it means to start to engage with so-called outsiders who's going to be part of their business going forward. And if you look across the talent pool, you know, you will find fewer serial entrepreneurs just because of the stage of development, and therefore the quality, the depth of management team tends to be quite a big difference, right? When you look at emerging versus mature markets like US and China, number one. Number two, if you think about the ecosystem, then definitely from a business model perspective, for each one, US, China, of course, Southeast Asia, would be very different with regards to ecosystem. That means that, you know, especially in emerging economy, like for example, you know, when we think about fintech investments on a global basis, the regulatory framework is somewhat mature, right? In the US, it's somewhat mature in China now, maybe accelerating a lot more over the last 5 years. But when you look at Southeast Asia, then some of the regulatory framework is still being formed, right? And so from that perspective, the ecosystem typically is not complete. Right, so I give you another perspective. So 20 years ago, when we were interacting with Alibaba in China, this was like the start of e-commerce, right? There was no payment. Everything was cash on delivery because logistics was not very developed, right? And therefore, Ali has to figure out how to get, you know, payment done. They have to figure out if they want to build their own logistic framework. And so in that sense, the type of startup that we see emerging economy, very similar to what we've seen in China in early days, is that they cannot afford to only do one thing, right? They have to figure out, you know, if whether it's logistic, whether it's payment, if they are part and parcel of their business logic, then if there are no other, you know, third party partner that can work with them, then obviously they may have to venture into those areas as well. So when I talk about ecosystem, it's two level, right? One is understanding the regulatory framework. Definitely a lot of gray areas, I would say, in emerging market, a lot more gray than black and white. And then secondly, you know, less ability to just focus, right? Like VCs always say focus. One thing in emerging economies, you may have to do more than just that one thing that you want to do, because while, like in the case of Alibaba, maybe their main focus at the time was e-commerce, but they had to build payment, they had to build cloud, they had to build logistics, because those were all part and parcel of that supply chain up and down, or the ecosystem, so to speak. So definitely in emerging economies right now, when we work with CEOs or portfolio companies, we have to take a higher level perspective and say, hey, you know, the build versus buy versus rent decision may not be as simple as what we have seen in mature economies, right? And therefore have to put that in the, you know, with the regulatory framework maturity at the background and said, and decide again, you know, what are the risks that we have to take. So definitely on the overall basis, the risk profile for companies in emerging economies will tend to be higher just because there's more pieces of the puzzle to be put together. And, you know, in the face of a less mature and experienced entrepreneur, right? So hopefully the higher risk implies higher returns over time. But we will see. But I think then the last point I'll throw in is that from an exit perspective as well, emerging economies, just the fact that they don't have as yet a very mature entrepreneurial startup ecosystem where there's a lot of role leaders or precedents of, you know, exits from startup environment, then definitely the exit situation, whether through IPO or M&A, will be harder to achieve in the emerging economies, right? So what we have seen in China is that the first 10 years, 2000 to 2010, the bulk of the exit has been through IPOs, because those companies, there were no one to buy them, right? They had to grow, they had to survive, they had to get big. And obviously when they're big enough and they're category leaders, they get public. And once they're public, you know, with the corresponding growth in their market share and their market value as well, then they can start to say, instead of building everything, they can buy. Right. And so for the last 10 years then, from 2010 to 2020 to now, the M&A market has been very active. This is then when the bigger guys with the right capital and the right value, they can now start to either consolidate or acquire. And therefore, the whole ecosystem from exit will be a bit more, you know, be richer, right, in terms of exits, whether it's IPOs or M&As. Emerging economies, if there were M&As, they tend to be smaller initially. And then you have to bet on the ultimate winner, which is the IPO. But once the IPO wave comes and you have, you know, great emergence of leaders, say, hopefully with the Grab of the world, the Gojek of the world, in this part of the world, Garena or C, then obviously it will give rise to the second wave, which is the potential of more M&A exits and therefore then more, you know, talent back into the ecosystem. So overall, I would say those are the, you know, three major points to differentiate between the different economies.
It's such a great start. Thanks for laying the lay of the land. And, you know, I'm super curious. So much of the work venture investing is really around the team and picking the right people to work with. So when it comes to finding your version of a talent and picking team in emerging in markets, what is your strategy and philosophy? And can you also walk us kind of through the process, right?
I would say that maybe, you know, other than the experience base, which could be very different from country to country, sector to sector, where we look at talent, the criteria actually will be similar, right? I think that for a very, very early stage company where there's less to go on, right, less numbers to crunch, you know, the model may not be mature, the market may not be mature, then of course, you know, other than saying, oh, product market fit, really it's about the team, as you highlighted. So on the team, I would say, if I have to point out, you know, just a few key areas, one, definitely US or China or Southeast Asia, I think it's the ability to learn. So today, there's just so many things happening, not just within the sector, but cross-sector. So the ability of the CEO to learn quickly, cross-sectors, like what's happening in the gamification world, the gaming world, that can be applied to enterprise. You know, what's happening in gamification that can be applied to education, right? Or, for example, the enterprise sales technique, you know, that we use for SaaS and platform as a service parts, can we you know, leverage that into new areas to think about, I don't know, social, right? Because in social, you tend to say it's kind of one time off your product. So I think one, the ability of CEOs, founders to quickly learn the selling points of each of the models that's out there and be able to maybe, you know, digest that, synthesize and come up with a brand new, different way to monetize. In the industry, they say cannot monetize, right? That's one way. Secondly, I think that, you know, today entrepreneurship is not new, right? And so there's so much information out there. Also, it means that you can learn from the playbook that has happened before, right? So a CEO who is sitting in Indonesia doesn't mean that, you know, he or she cannot learn from the rest of the world, right? Knowing how certain things or models is taken up in the US, looking at what has happened in China could be a playbook that could give them a few months into insight into the future, right? Or even a few years into the future has the potential what may happen. So I think number one, ability to learn becomes very important. And then two, when you're early on, you know, and you haven't raised a lot of money, there's only your own charisma, right? So the founding team's charisma, their passion, and charisma can be characterized by their passion around, you know, the project or the company, the product that they're trying to build. It can be, you know, sometimes just your vision to try and change the world in certain directions, right? To, like, if I again use the fintech to serve the underserved, you know, things like that, right? Or education, right? To bring more quality education to the long tail, right? A lot of the folks in remote areas that actually have no access to education. So I think that's the second aspect is always that, right? Can you early on in the cycle of your startup be able to get a team together that shares the same level of passion and vision? So, and sometimes you have nothing else to offer them other than your ability to bring them together and promise them a great future with the stock of a company that just got started. So I think in the early days, ability to learn and then ability to influence with the right personality and charisma becomes very important. Now, when companies are in their mid to late stage, as you know, I think GGV, we do multi-stage, right? So we come in at seed and early A, we can go invest all the way to even pre-IPO. So at the mid to later stage, then definitely the both, you know, all the elements of what we talk about product market fit is important, right? So it's not just about the team. The team's ability to execute should translate into real numbers, whether it's the business model, whether it's their growth rate, all that becomes really important. And so those, I would say, then would be a closer holistic package, you know, that we use to evaluate if we want to make the investments.
Mm, awesome. On this ability to learn and charisma, how do you test that?
I think that you can't test it. I think you feel it, you know, by spending time, right? So you spend time talking to the entrepreneurs. You know, some entrepreneurs, you ask a question, they'll answer the question, right? Mm. You ask a second question, you answer the question. Some entrepreneurs will share with you, right, naturally, their vision, how they've gone through the path. So I think by asking certain questions about what they have gone through, about, you know, why they are doing what they want to do, I think that's important, right? Fueling. Can they even convey that charisma to an investor who may not even know the business very well on the first meeting? That becomes important. And then, you know, with subsequent meeting, you know, does that feeling get enhanced, right? Like more detailed questions, more structured thinking. Is the CEO not just marketing, but can he or she extend the whole vision into something that's tangible and executable? So I think that's one area, right? Spending a lot of time with the founder or co-founders. And then I would add that actually in the very early days as well, we still do quite a bit of management due diligence. So it's not just the founding team. We try and go to, you know, kind of N minus one, right? Minus one, minus two level. And when we talk to their kind of co-founding employees or early employees, we typically try and do it one-to-one as well, even if it's on Zoom, I do it one-to-one. And one of the key questions is their assessment of their boss, right? The assessment of their CEO. So the cross-checking becomes quite important. You'd be amazed, I think, people talk. Mm. When they're on a one-on-one basis, they talk for good or for bad. I think they will share their perspective. And I think that also helps to gauge the level of buy-in that, you know, the lieutenant that the founder has built. You know, is there enough buy-in in the initial stage, the quality of people that they're able to hire? I think that actually also allows us to get a better handle on, you know, if this is a pre-revenue, pre-product, but the team, do they have the right element? Now, I don't think they will all score 100% or be A+. And so at the end of the day, we have to say, hey, maybe in emerging economy, emerging country A, you know, a B plus is good enough because there's really no A minus, you know, and the B plus may be a C in China. So we have to make that adjustment. Obviously, if we truly see like an A team, then, you know, usually I think the valuation will reflect where they are, right, and the quality of the team. So it's a bit relative on that basis.
Gotcha.
But I would say we cannot use the same gauge on all economies given the development stage of each one.
Jenny, I want to ask a little bit more around, you know, there are many companies headquartered in the US, often very well endowed and, you know, well-capitalized, amazing talent, have found limited success building for emerging markets, right? Across, you know, we have so many examples. What challenges do you think those teams have overlooked?
Well, I think that today, a lot of them knows the challenges that they face, right? Because it's been, what, 10, 20 years?
Yeah.
And enough of the foreign companies have tried, you know, to compete even on business model that seems globalized, right? I think so. Definitely, I think number one is the local and cultural difference. A lot of times, that's actually quite important, right? If you look at Southeast Asia and look at the countries, 10, 20, 30 countries, right? Each one is very different. If you just use an example of ride sharing, the local dynamics is different. The local situation, the local transportation mode and vehicles are different. The regulatory framework is different. The need is different. The ability to pay is different. Now, while you can say that the to do ride sharing has a business model is similar, it doesn't mean that just exporting a US model is going to work, right? Because let's say, just giving Uber as example, Uber in the US started with a black car service. It was actually geared for the higher end users who can afford to pay, you know, own chauffeured type of services. In China, it actually started with the taxi fleets, right? That's why Didi is called Didi, right? it's calling a cab. I think in Asia as well, to a certain extent, it wasn't quite a separate carpool. It is actually a community carpool that started, right? And so there are nuances and differences from a local perspective. And then the cultural ability to say, you know, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, actually has to be localized. So I would say every single model we have seen, you know, the successful companies are the ones that really send their best people to the ground. And sometimes these best people are from the ground, right? Versus trying to hire someone from the US who's never been to, say, Vietnam, who's never been to Thailand, who's never been to Indonesia, and said, just go figure this out. That may not work, right? But you may be better off actually hiring someone local who understand those nuances and then have senior management commitment to listen and make changes. While, you know, most companies like to have one product to take on the world, it's not easy, right? If you want to be a global company, you may need to have multiple products for each market, mm-hmm, right? Versus one product fit for the world. Because, you know, while the world is quite different, to say. Very different. So I would say, you know, local cultural differences and I think tool execution.
Yeah. So on this note, any, you know, great growth hack stories in emerging markets that you came across based on your experience with really high growth companies, right?
Yeah. So I would say definitely, you know, there were some companies that was being discussed, right? So we can highlight each one of them. If you think about what Xiaomi has done selling a phone, right, in the early days, one of the successful tactics is their online marketing, right? They were one of the earliest to come up with online marketing, really riding off the scarcity effect, right? To say, hey, you know, if you come pre-order, prepaid at 12 o'clock, you know, or midnight, you know, this Jan 1st, for example, you will be one of the 1,000 users who's going to get access to this cool phone, right? And so I mean, now it may seem very, very typical because all the e-commerce players actually uses this, right? Like limited time only, certain discount over a certain period and then prepayment or pre-order. But I think the earlier day for Xiaomi, it's actually been very important to create brand awareness, brand following, and the whole fact of the matter is almost like limited edition, right? So you'll be like one of the earlier guy to acquire the product. And so I think that really has helped to spread the brand when the company is very early on. And of course, if the product is good, then it continues to enhance themselves. And from a business model perspective, it's a great model because you get prepayment versus, you know, having your cash flow stuck in the channels. Then you see other companies, right? So a lot of tools companies we've seen in China, including say the ed tech, education tech sector, like Zhuye Bang of the world. Then what they do, or even YY of the world in the gaming world, is that they started off with a tool. In the case of YY, the tool is a communication tool that allows gamers online to talk, communicate, do command and control of multi-user games online, but it's a free tool, right? And that tool is actually very important for the game clan community when they are together and they need to go attack a castle together, right? So the ability to be synchronized and to be coordinated through this online tool becomes a very important gel or glue to bring the users together. And then once they're on it, whether it's when they're in the game or outside the game, they're communicating and talking. That's how YY started, right? Through a very high quality tool that allows communication on a large scale to happen with very little latency. And they offer it free when all the competitors were actually offering it as a telecom service, right? What they were looking at is that this is a tool for gamers, designed by gamers for gamers, right? And that really helped the initial acquisition of the, you know, very sticky user base. And over time, again, I think YY is a great example. Their business model when it came out was completely different from anything else you've seen in the world, because they were the ones who also started the whole concept of virtual gifting, right? Where you can go right to a concert in a virtual BMW, right? And be known in kind of, now we call it metaverse, yeah. Right? A new world, different personality. So I would say that it's in, one is through the tool-based, but high-quality tech-based, where they don't charge for the utility, but they use it as a way to acquire users. And then, you know, they monetize with a completely different way, but with good understanding of what users in the metaverse actually needs. In the case of Zhuye Bang, right, it's a tool for doing homework. And, you know, that homework for K-12 students, it's for Asia countries in particular, is a must, right? And so, you know, trying to help the parents, trying to help the kids as they are at home every day with homework load, you know, how do you better learn faster in a more structured manner? So again, I think in Asia, we see a lot of this tool-based type startups. When they start off, it may look very simple, but with good product, they were able to penetrate. Right. Whereas I think that we're starting to see that as well. Some of this trend, you know, learning from China, going into the rest of Southeast Asia, and of course, back to the US.
Awesome. Excellent. Jenny, I want to switch here a little bit to you, right? Jenny, you, since 2012, you've been consistently recognized as Forbes Global 100 VC Midas list, and also actually the first woman to break the top 10 of that list in 2015. You know, I think we all know venture is a pretty much male-dominated industry. So being a woman, how do you think you stand out? And what is your superpower when it comes to helping portfolio companies?
Yeah, I actually don't think about standing out. it's really out. Not that. I think that at the end, we all have to find our passion, right? If you're going to live 80 years old or 70 years old, you know, you want to be doing things that you love, right? Just like what we tell entrepreneurs, go after the things you love, figure out what your passion is, and then go all in. So I would say it's the same, right? There's no difference. I think I chose the venture industry because it's one where it allows me to really it's tech investing, to be at the forefront, to look at emerging trends, to imagine what the new world is going to look like with all this cool technology trends. And then to meet with entrepreneurs who share those vision, maybe even more than me, who has a way to realize those vision. That's what gets me going. I don't think about, is this male or female? I think about, you know, is this a job I love? And I think that's what keeps me, you know, going, right? And then being able to suspend disbelief, to give the entrepreneurs that time to share their vision. And then, of course, you know, to be a good investor, you obviously need to do a few things right, right? You have to really be able to look at those trends and put them in the right time frame, right? While we try not to time the market, you do not want to be too early, right? If you're too early in the market, you may end up, you know, trying to make a lot of investment the first 10 years when the sector is not ready. And when it's ready for harvesting, you kind of run out of gas, right? So I think the ability to judge the technology window becomes also somewhat important. You don't have to be exactly right, but I would say in five-year time window, you got to be, you know, more or less kind of on track, right? So I think that's one, the right trend so that, you know, it's riding on the right growth sector. And then two, having, you know, the time, the ability to learn quickly from all these experts within particular sectors becomes also very important, right? So we are, I mean, sometimes people mistake VCs and said we are bankers. We are not bankers. You know, we're not there just to do an IPO process. We're not there just to do an M&A process. Actually, we are kind of partner in crime in the world of entrepreneurship. You know, we are the partner alongside the entrepreneur as they try and build their vision. And so to be there, to be in maybe not the driver's seat, but the passenger driver's seat, right, next to the driver, you have to be almost a mini expert, right? You don't have to be a full expert, but you have to know enough, hopefully wide enough, to be able to spar with the entrepreneur, to give the entrepreneur value-added ideas, direction, be able to, you know, have that brainstorming meaningfully, right? And that's where the value is being found and formed as well. And that's where we learn, right? As a VC, we can meet, you know, 100 companies in the same sector. And if we end up investing, you know, in one or two companies, like that's the ability we're able to bring in kind of the landscape map, you know, the directional map. And as we discuss with the CEO, what's the right direction, we are in the ability not to dictate, right, but to actually brainstorm and say, hey, you know, there are issues here that we've seen. If you go down this route, if you go down this other route, looks good, but, you know, you have to take care of potential pitfalls, right? So I think the ability to be the trusted partner becomes very important. So I think one is identifying the right trend, identifying the right company. And then after that, the bulk of what an investor do is that we are as much part of the entrepreneurship, you know, building. Because then if we are, let's say, for example, we're a Series A investor, you know, you got a couple of years to go. On average, we made a quick analysis from a venture perspective, from GGB perspective, it takes about 7 to 8 years on average from first investment to final exit, which means that it could be, it takes them 5 years to get an IPO stage and then another 3 years, you know, for us to exit. It could be that they get public after 3 years, but then we may want to sit with them longer, you know, and we may hold for another 5 years, right, after they're public. So, but on average, it is still not a short venture. It is a pretty long commitment. And so, you know, you gotta have the right ability to love that space enough to be always there. And you can imagine, right, in the economic cycle, we always said the global economic cycle, 2-3 years, you see cycles, right? 7-8 years, you're going to see 3-4 cycles. And that could be up cycles and mostly down cycles, right? How do you then, you know, work with them? How do you buffer that? How do you, you know, take bad news and be able to digest those? So I would say that, you know, the path and choice of a VC investor is not easy. I don't think it's about just saying this is a job. I think it has to be a passion, because you need to be super patient. And then you have to continuously learn and be able to take bad news. In our industry, bad news comes earlier than good news. So, and then if you can hold up to the end, you know, that's where you see the upside. Right. Right. So awesome. great business, but not for the faint-hearted.
You're clearly definitely not a faint-hearted. So awesome. In the last 2 minutes, Jenny, I want to do a quick, you know, kind of a 30-second question. So first, in summary, what do you think made a great VC investor?
So I think one, ability to learn quickly, learn broadly, and yet dive deeply into the sector that you want to invest. So they're a mini expert. Two, you have to love people. It's a people business. And then third, you're a problem solver, because there'll be problems to solve every single day, every single deal.
What advice do you have for your audience of innovators, right? Startup founders, innovators in emerging markets.
So I think definitely only do a startup if you truly understand the need that you're trying to solve. And you feel passionately about this, because it is a long journey. It cannot be a short-term, you know, passion. It got to be long-term. Yeah. So I would say, and then execute, focus on execution.
Focus. How do you stay sharp, and what book, podcast, or blog inspires you?
Well, I would say that the best way to stay sharp is to go out there and talk to entrepreneurs, because they are more recent. You know, when books, you know, podcasts comes about, they are already lagging the market. In your spare time, read, listen, but actually the best way is to go out there and talk to entrepreneurs, because they are at the forefront, and they are, you know, they are, if you talk to the right guys, the vibe on the market will be very current.
Awesome. Cool. Thank you, Jenny. I think, you know, we've really come to the end of this podcast. Thank you so much for really giving us an insider look into why GGB is successful today and why you are the investors of choice for many, many emerging market founders. You know, even as a practitioner myself, I think years and years of experience that you have shared today is very, very valuable for me. So I want to thank you again for your time, and I'm looking forward to having another chat with you sometime soon.
No, thank you, Pin. Welcome entrepreneurs to come look for me.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kaufman Fellows.